Michael Lynch is Professor of Philosophy at the University of Connecticut and one of the world's leading philosophers in the area concerning the pluralistic versions of truth. In this interview and discussion, he addresses the problems found in treating truth as a monolithic concept and argues in favour of treating truth as a concept that is different in different domains of inquiry, hence its distinction when applied to the natural sciences, the humanities and the social sciences. And explains why the one unifying category regarding the concept of truth is its functionality.
There are popular theories of truth throughout the 20th century and perhaps previously, such as deflationary theory of truth, correspondence theory of truth, and coherence theory of truth. A lot of these have problems and are very contentious for these issues. From your perspective, what are some of the problems with some of the theories that are currently on the table regarding the philosophical concept of truth?
So I think one general thing we can say about traditional views of truth is that they are often, with some exceptions, overgeneralized. William James, after all, thought that it was sort of a compulsive habit of philosophers to overgeneralize, which is a great overgeneralization if there ever was one. But he was onto something, I think, if you when he applied that to theories of truth, which he did, in my view. So let me sketch a little bit about how I think about theories of truth, and then I'll talk about the ways in which I think that, in some sense, the insights of past traditional theories have been overgeneralized to, in a sense, I think, the detriment of those theories. So I'll give a little framework and then talk about return to the point of generalization. So the way I have of thinking about how truth has developed is that, you know, traditionally, philosophers have thought that truth has had a sort of single essence. So I think traditionally, philosophers were attracted to some sort of monism about truth. And, you know, the oldest monist view, one which you've heard a lot about and the listeners have heard a lot about, they've been listening to these podcasts, is something like that's often called the correspondence view of truth. And I won't go into great detail about what that is, but the basic idea is that beliefs are true when they correspond to the world. And on this way of looking at things, beliefs or sentences are sort of like maps. They're accurate or true when they, you know, represent the world as it is, not as we hope or dream it or wish it to be. So beliefs are sort of like little maps. You know, an alternative view is not maybe as old, but not new either, is that beliefs are true when they hang together, when they form some sort of coherent narrative or story. This might have started with Hegel, but I think it probably goes back farther than that. And this might be called the coherence theory. Truths don't need to fit the world, they need to fit each other. That's the basic thought. So there's other traditional views. We could talk about pragmatism, which is certainly linked to the coherence theory, but let's just stick with those two right now. So both of these views are versions of what I just called monism. They think that truth has some hidden essence. Truth is something that we need a substantive metaphysical theory to tell us about, and that theory is going to reveal the one property that all and only true beliefs or propositions or sentences have in common. Now, in recent years, I think many people who work on truth for a living, and I'm, I guess, one of those folks, have given up on monism of either this correspondence type or the coherence type that I mentioned. Broadly speaking, they've given up both on the sort of more realist-oriented correspondence theory and the more anti-realist coherence theory. And why is that? Well, it's part because, and this is now getting back to the point about generalization, it's part because it looks as if while both theories seem to work in certain domains or for certain sorts of examples, both theories seem to run aground on counterexamples when we try to apply them to different areas. So, for example, it often seems quite plausible to say that when we're talking about white snow or green grass, or tables and chairs, or mountains, molehills, and so forth and so on, that our beliefs about those sorts of things are true when, in some sense, they fit the world and they map the world. But when we talk about things like numbers or morality, it's less clear to lots of philosophers that it really makes sense to talk about our beliefs mapping any external reality. And for different reasons in both cases. In the case of morality, it seems like, you know, we do tend to think that things are right or wrong. We certainly act that way. And so we tend to act, for example, in a way that suggests that we believe that the propositions that announce what's right or wrong are apt for truth or falsity. And we give reasons for our moral beliefs and so forth and so on. So they seem to be truth apt, yet there doesn't seem to be anything like right or wrongness out in the natural world, which are those beliefs can map. Nonetheless, we might think that, well, those beliefs can fit together. They can cohere. They can form a narrative strand, and that narrative strand can resist and it can remain coherent and have some internal structure that will be stable despite added input from the external world. And we might think, in a sense, there are more or less coherent moral stories of the world from a moral point of view. There are some stories that are absolutely incoherent, but other stories, other frameworks for understanding what's right or wrong, which make more sense, at least for some contexts. We might incline to think that, well, in some, you know, when it comes to physical objects, our beliefs about those sorts of things seem to be, you know, apt for some sort of correspondence to the world. But our beliefs about morality don't seem apt for correspondence, but they seem apt for truth. So we might think, well, that they seem true or false in the sort of coherence way. And that's right where the view that I favor sort of enters the stage. It tends to think that the pluralist about truth is somebody who says, look, the problem with the more traditional views of truth is that they overgeneralized certain important insights, but insights that really don't apply to truth itself, but to the properties that realize or manifest truth in certain domains. The pluralist about truth says, look, there could be more than one property in virtue of which beliefs could be true. In some domains and in some contexts, beliefs might be true in virtue of fitting each other or being coherent. In other properties, in other domains, it could be that the beliefs in those domains, let's say about the natural world, are true in virtue of having the property of corresponding to that world. So the thought that the pluralist has is that there's something right in all these earlier views, but what's wrong about them is their attempt to say that truth has one and only one essence in all domains.
So essentially, it isn't a monolithic or monism form of truth. It is what things are being said that constitute truth. So it's the property of being truth. And that's obviously, you can see how that can be applicable in different disciplines. So clearly, what constitutes the true existence of a particle in physics is different what constitutes truth about a moral value.
Yes, that's right. So one thing just sort of abstracting from the technical details about truth for a moment and just sort of, you know, adding some context. One of the intuitions that I have that tends to lead me in the pluralist direction is sort of, in a sense, larger than the technical details. I've always felt that when we are, you know, just like the examples that you cited, when we talk about truth in the sciences, we're not necessarily talking about the same thing that we're talking about, and I think this is pretty obvious to people, when we're talking about truth in, let's say, the humanities. But notice I say truth in the humanities. When I think about fields of the humanities and the social sciences, I think about them as disciplines that are engaged in inquiry, that are engaged in trying to figure out some truths about the world. That's not all they're doing. They're also doing all sorts of other wonderful things, lending understanding, helping us discover aspects of our identity. But one of the things that the humanities can do is tell us something about knowledge, to give us knowledge. And knowledge involves truth. So one of the things that I've sort of in general been interested in as an intellectual, not just a philosopher, is to attempt to try to explain how it is that that's possible. How is it possible that the humanities and work in the humanities and the social sciences can be aimed at truth when it seems as if on face value that type of truth that they're aimed at, if it's at all, it is not at all like the sort of truth that we aim at in natural science. I think one way that, you know, a dominant sort of way of approaching these issues over the last half century or more has been, look, to say, if there's truth at all, it's to be found in the natural sciences. And we really should sort of give up on the idea that in the social sciences and the humanities, we're really pursuing truth. And we might be doing something else that's important, but it's not that. The problem with that, I mean, from a big global perspective, is that it's problematic philosophically, but it's also problematic in a sense politically, because what it does is it deeply undermines the cultural role that humanities and the social sciences really can play. Because if their advocates, its chief advocates, are standing up and saying, you know what, at the end of the day, we're really not about knowledge, it's really hard to have other intellectuals, other people, take you seriously. And I think that work in the humanities and social sciences is very serious. So I wanted to add that as a little bit of context for the listeners, just to sort of see how, show you how these, you know, in a sense, rather abstract, obscure debates over the nature of truth actually have, I think, very relevant and large cultural impact.
No, sure. But I would agree with that, Mark. It's very interesting. Clearly, I think anyone can appreciate that a cultural value or an understanding of social norms provides knowledge and understanding that isn't true in a pure externalist, empirically verifiable sense, like the frequency of light. But clearly, as you're saying, to have any kind of understanding in the first place in any social sciences at least rests on some assumptions of what constitutes truth in that area. So if you're talking about cultural anthropology, for example,
yes,
you make certain assumptions of what the understanding is, and that is based on some understanding of some true value of cultural norms, whether it's from the West to the East. But people can understand that, okay, it's not objectively truth in terms of statistically verifiable empirical knowledge, but clearly there is a truth about understanding about how people do different things differently in different societies.
That's right.
And it's also perhaps worth pointing out here, because a lot of people that engage in multi or pluralistic views of truth sometimes get accused of being just complete postmodernists that are out there with no objective form of truth. But you can confirm this other way. But from my understanding of you, you're not saying that there isn't no form of truth whatsoever. It's just all up in the air, winner takes all. No, you're saying that the truth in one domain, such as the natural sciences, or the truth in mathematics, is different from truth in literature and the social sciences.
Exactly. And so the real technical question, the real important question for the philosopher, right, the thing that gets somebody, you know, like myself, sort of, you know, busily writing articles and books for the last couple of decades on this, is, you know, the obvious question, well, okay, so if there's these different kinds of truth, what makes them both kinds of, you know, truth? What is it that really makes whatever property you're saying, Lynch, you know, people are saying to me, whatever property realizes truth in the social sciences or literature, what would, you know, if it's, let's say, some sort of coherence, what makes it the case that that sort of coherence really is a property that can make a belief true? What's in common between that and correspondence? And that's where I think you need to get into some philosophical theorizing, and where I've introduced what I've called the functionalist theory in order to answer that question.
Take this opportunity to expand further on that, on the functionalist theory of how it addresses those problems you just mentioned, Michael.
Well, so the basic point that I want to make is, look, if you want to know what makes, let's say, coherence in some domains and correspondence in the other, both properties that can at least potentially realize or manifest truth, you need to ask, well, the simple question, well, what do you mean by truth? But rather, I think, than trying to give a definition of that concept in a straightforward way, you need to take a clue from the philosophy of mind, and as it's been practiced in cognitive science and analytic philosophy for the last 30 years, and understand truth as a functional concept or property. In other words, here's the way of thinking about it. You could say that when we think about what truth is, we should start with thinking about first what it does. What sort of job does the property of truth do in our cognitive economy? That is, how is it connected to various other properties and concepts that we're interested in? So think about it this way. You know, sometimes if we want to know what, if we're trying to define, let's say, what it is to be the U.S. president, part of what you would the way you'd answer that question is you'd say, well, to be the U.S. president is to have these certain executive privileges and powers, and to be related to the Congress in certain ways, and to be related to the judiciary in certain ways, and be related to the military in certain ways, and be related to the voters in certain ways. In other words, you sort of give a job description that lays out what the duties and responsibilities of that role actually are, of that job. In the same way, you might say, well, you can give a job description of what it is for a belief to be true. Well, for a belief to be true, it's got to be related to other beliefs in certain ways and with regard to logic. It's got to be the case that true beliefs have a property that is carried through in valid inferences. In order for a belief to be true, it's got to be related to warrant or evidence in a certain way. It's got to be the case that true beliefs with that property, the truth property, can be supported by evidence, but being supported by evidence isn't by itself, being supported at least by evidence at a time, isn't itself constituting or entailing that it's true. And you've got to say that beliefs that have the property of truth are related to inquiry in a certain way. They're the sorts of beliefs that we aim to have when we're asking questions, trying to figure out something about some topic. So all these sort of platitudes that I just gave put together give a sort of description of what truth is. And that, I think, is what we can say about truth at the most general level. At the most general level, what we can say about truth is ultimately a functional description of the sort I just described. It's a collection of truisms or platitudes that together form this, as I said, job description of the property. Then what you say is you turn around and you say, well, okay, are there, this is, as David Lewis made very clear many years ago, this is the sort of general strategy that you often take in defining abstract properties, whether you're doing that in physics or in mathematics or the social sciences, cultural anthropology. You define a property and you look around and you say, well, okay, is there anything in the world that sort of does that job? Well, it can turn out, and this is what the pluralist suggests that, well, what does the job of truth in that one job, that single job that I described, that what does that job in the case of morality, let's say, or politics, might be quite different from what does the job or plays the role, functional role, in the case of physics. And you need to investigate to find out what those properties are. So what unifies truth is its function. What diversifies truth, what makes it many, so to speak, are the different properties that fulfill that function or play the role.
So you're willing to accept that there is a certain monoism to the general concept in truth in terms of it serves a particular function. We can see this throughout different disciplines, yet as you've been already alluding to many times, it's the different properties that fill that function in different disciplines. So on the one hand, it's a general concept, but in different disciplines, it's clearly not the same attribute that requires truth there.
Exactly. And I think one reason it's really important to put it that way has to do with certain technical issues that would arise if you didn't have that single notion. So over and above the worry that I raised earlier, which is, look, you know, if there's going to be these different properties, what makes them all properties of truth? Well, I've just given an answer to that. So there's also some technical issues, which have to do with logic, essentially. If we do want to define validity, deductive validity, as truth preservation or necessary truth preservation across inference, you're going to need a single property that's preserved, because one of the usefulness, or we might say the useful aspect of logic, is that what it allows us to do is reason across all sorts of different domains. And logic is very general. So, for example, we can have inferences that have premises that are partly moral or political or anthropological, and which have conclusions which don't have any normative concept involved, or vice versa. In other words, we can just reason across different sorts of domains. And of course, if there isn't any unified notion of truth, then it would mean that we would be, in a sense, equivocating as we say, as we do in a valid inference, that we assume that if the premises are true, the conclusion must be true. Well, if the truth is in different senses, you've got a problem. And the same for, you know, if you think about compositionality, the fact that we can put beliefs together from different domains with connectives, you know, and we can say, for example, 2 + 2 = 4 and murder is wrong. Well, what makes that proposition true? It's neither solely mathematical or moral, right? So if there's no one notion of truth, you're going to have a harder time explaining what makes that one proposition true. As it is, you're still going to have a hard time explaining that, and that's, I've done a lot of work on that. But those are just what, you know, just so the listeners understand, there's both intuitive reasons to go the route that I was suggesting we go, and also technical reasons.
Two things really before I let you go. The first would be, there's been a lot of work contemporary, someone working on pluralistic versions of truth like you have. That's probably at the more recent developments in truth in the last decade or so. Clearly truth has been, as we alluded to at the top of the interview and discussion there, about the different versions of truth that have come about in the 20th century and previously to that. What do you think, if you can put your hand, obviously you haven't got a crystal ball, but what are some of the interesting future developments in the area of truth going forward that you expect to come to the fore in the next few years or decades? So
that's a great question. I think there are a couple different issues that are particularly pressing and I think might become increasingly more central. One is the issue that has been discussed, but I think is getting more discussion now perhaps than ever before, and I think it's going to continue, is the question of the value of truth, why it matters. And the reason that seems important is because one way, as Plato taught us a long time ago, one way to really figure out the nature of something, find out what it is to ask why we should care about it. And I think that's something that is going to have some particularly, you know, important to us, and not just in a political sense, but just in a technical sense. The questions about the value of truth and knowledge are playing a particularly more and more increasingly prominent role, I might say, in epistemology, and I think that's going to continue. Clearly, I certainly hope that the question of whether truth has more than one nature or one nature, many natures, or none, which is the deflationist view we haven't talked about, I think that's going to continue to be important. I think the third problem that's going to continue to be important is the question of the logical paradoxes. For example, the question of a liar. So consider a sentence that says, in effect, I'm false, right? Mm-hmm. Is it true or false, or both, or neither, or meaningless? Each answer gets tried and it has its cost. I think that's been around for a long time. It's not going to go away and it's going to continue to be an issue. And partly, I think, because there's a growing question about how those issues in logic interact with the other issues that I mentioned. And that is, I think, a question that has not been worked on sufficiently. There's certainly been people that have worked on it, Michael Glansberg, J.C. Beale, others. But the issues of how it is that the question of the paradoxes intersects, if at all, with the questions, the metaphysical and value questions that I raised a moment ago, that's new territory.
Paradox in certain statements would again raise issues in the area of logic, in like P is P by definition, and then obviously some of the moral values in ethics, which is again you've been marrying throughout this interview and discussion. What about yourself right now going forward? What are your current research areas, any papers you're working on? I know you've just gotten a new head of Department of Humanities. Any books you've got planned? What are you currently working on now as an academic?
As an academic, I, of course, am always working in some respect on issues of truth because I've done a lot of work on that. And it's once you start doing some work on material, you find you're always returning to it. At least I always am. So I'm still curious about some of the questions I mentioned about truth. But what's mostly occupying my time right now are two questions in epistemology. I'm working on a book right now, tentatively entitled The Knowledge Machine, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. This is a different part of my intellectual life that is more oriented towards the public than my work on truth, per se. And that, as the title suggests, is about how knowledge is changing in the face of our life and what I like to call the data sphere.
Is there a publication date for that at all?
Well, we're hoping that it's going to come out in about a year, if we're lucky. I've also been working a lot on privacy and the NSA. Disapproving of some of the actions of the NSA, and I've been writing about that in the New York Times and various other venues, such as, and been talking about it in various other venues around the country.